This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average. And auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Hey everyone, Gil Gross here, and welcome to the 2024 Wimbledon First Round Mailbag. I have taken your comments on my new Discord server, link is in the description of that, and as always, the YouTube community tab. I cannot wait to get into all of your comments as the first round of Wimbledon has concluded, with the exception of some matches that were suspended due to darkness and need to finish tomorrow. Hope you've been enjoying the tennis so far. Thank you for tuning in to this first Wimbledon show. Whether you're watching or listening, here's what you can expect the rest of the way. I'm going to be doing shows at the conclusion of every round until the quarterfinal. And then once the quarterfinal stage begins, I'll be zooming in and doing more match-by-match kind of stuff. This is, of course, a mailbag, but as we move forward, second round, third round, etc., I'll be talking much more about the results and the tennis and the storylines that are emerging. I'll only do a little bit of it at the top here because I don't want to just completely ignore the first round results. But first rounds of majors are always interesting for me, because I'm always watching so many matches at once. And a lot of people ask me about just how I analyze matches and what my process is, or what my, I don't know, my keys are to trying to do it at the highest level possible. And one of the first things I always say is starts with focus. Starts with focusing on one match and really locking in on a point-by-point basis and trying to find trends and watching carefully, honestly. Like, it's not rocket science in that sense. But in the first round, when you're watching 2-3 matches at once constantly, you really do lose a ton. And I don't believe that I'm always able to look at these results. And sometimes a match will go final, and I'll be like, okay, I watched a lot of that, but do I really understand why what happened happened? Which is usually what I try to make an effort to understand and explain on the show. It's kind of what I try to do. No, sometimes those matches go final and I say, okay, I'm on it, but I didn't really catch it as well as I probably could have or should have had I been able to focus more on it. That being said, I do want to go over some results. Day one, first of all, what really stood out was the comebacks. Last year, there were 4 2 sets to love comebacks the entire tournament. This year, there were 4 on day one. Lloyd Harris came back against Alex Mickelson, won it with one of the best match points I've ever seen. If you have not seen the match point, let me tell you how you can find it. If you subscribe to The Draw, you can go to the link in the description, or you can go to thedraw.tennis. I put the video of the match point in this week's edition of The Draw, which dropped this morning, which is Tuesday morning, as it does every week. And if you're not aware, it is a curation of the best tennis content on the internet. And it is a newsletter. So it shows up in your email as newsletters tend to do. But you can still go back and read previous editions, such as the one that was sent out this morning at thedraw.tennis. Anyway, Lloyd Harris over Alex Mickelson was one. Francis Tiafoe beat Matteo Arnaldi, and Tiafoe looked more creative and more joyful than I've seen him in a very long time. Huge for him. We'll talk more about him. I believe that there are some Tiafoe questions in the mailbag. Bublik over Mencik. First of all, really big for Sasha Bublik's ranking defending fourth round points and kind of on the cusp of seeding territory as, you know, we head into, obviously there's only one major left at the end of this one, but still significant even in the Masters 1000s now that they're 32 seeds. And Bublik did a good job just turning around his focus level and his mental state. And we've actually seen sometimes that doesn't happen. Like sometimes I think of his first round match against Thiem at the US Open last year. He comes out, he just doesn't have it and he never finds it. And in this case, he was at least able to find it. I'm still really adamant on Mensik though. I spent so much of the time watching that Bublik-Mensik match, and I watched quite a bit of it. I was thinking about how much I love Mensik as a prospect, even though it was Bublik who came through at the end. But Mensik did seem to lose his legs, and his serving effectiveness certainly declined as the match went on, and he struggled in some big spots to finish some volleys, even though he volleyed well at the start of the match. So that was kind of interesting. Last one was Arthur Cazot over Zizou Bergs. Very high-quality match. Razor-thin margins. Cazot really impressed me with just his movement on the grass. His movement tends to impress me. And he was able to kind of be a little bit more solid, rely on his athleticism more. Bergs made some errors in some big spots when Cazot didn't, and it went to a fifth-set tiebreak. And Cazot just slightly edged out Zizou, who's had a big grass court season. So a lot to be proud of for him. Djokovic played today, moving on from the two sets to love comebacks. It's funny because, you know, he beat Vít Kopřiva handedly. Very, very one-sided match, particularly if you look at the score line. I don't think Kopřiva won more than two games in a set, if I'm not mistaken. Yeah, it was 6-1, 6-2, 6-2. I think the sentiment, at least that I consumed after the match, was, holy moly, Djokovic looked good. This is amazing. It's incredible. But a lot of people came in with low expectations or at least a lot of uncertainty because of the knee thing. Obviously, you guys know if you watched my preview and my predictions that I actually came in with somewhat high expectations of Djokovic because I simply don't think that he'd be playing Wimbledon if he was going to come out and he wasn't going to be able to move well. I don't think there was a world in which Djokovic was going to come out gimpy, limpy, weak in the legs, and he's going to put himself in a position where he's getting into a dogfight with Vít Kopřiva on grass. I just don't. So a lot of people were super thrilled with how Novak looked. I thought, okay, great performance. Game looked sharp. Serve looked sharp. Movement, and I'm disagreeing a little bit with what John McEnroe said on the ESPN broadcast, what Nick Kyrgios said on the ESPN broadcast. I don't think he looked completely liberated when moving out to his right and sliding off of his right leg, which is running to his forehand side. I don't think that looked completely normal. It didn't look to me like he was digging into that corner with 100% intensity or commitment. And sometimes it even looked awkward, and sometimes I think the balance was a little bit off in situations where it normally wouldn't be. So that's the only thing I saw with Novak that I felt was evidence that it isn't fully there. But some of that could be psychological. Some of that could be strategic, just not trying to take any risks when clearly he doesn't need to. And I guess I would just remind everyone, when he had that hamstring pull in Australia, he was not hitting, and this was 2 years ago. I said tear, actually. I don't know if there's technically really much of a difference, but the hamstring injury. He was not hitting his open stance sliding backhand. Just wasn't hitting it. I think it was his left leg with the hamstring issue. So he did not have the ability to hit that shot, and it was okay. At the end of the day, you are only going to find yourself in that situation on a finite number of points, relatively small. It's not a shot that Djokovic wants to be hitting point in and point out. It means that you're in a defensive situation, so you're trying to avoid it to begin with. And then there are other ways to still try to defend your backhand, even if you're not hitting that open stance kind of sliding backhand that Djokovic is so good at. It is a shot he wants to be able to hit, But we saw at the Australian Open, and I think at one point in the tournament, late in the tournament, he did start to hit it again. But he can get through the first week of a slam without hitting that particular shot, just for an example. So this was another example of that against Vít Kopárová, where he does not need to have the full extent of his forehand defense unlocked in order to win that match handedly. But for me, I think it was the first time I've seen Novak's serve dominate since the Australian Open. He served great against Adrian Mannarino in Melbourne. He served great against Taylor Fritz in Melbourne. I had not seen his serve have such an impact since Australia. And that has to happen throughout this tournament in order for Djokovic to go all the way and to be a title contender. But I think it's so easy just watching him on the clay to forget that Djokovic has the ability to legitimately take over matches with his first serve. And over the years at Wimbledon, we've seen first serve win percentages around 85% on a consistent basis because he's that pinpoint with his spot serving and he's that clinical on the plus one and moving on from there. Two more results I want to cover. And then I was going to talk about the Vondrousova upset, defending champion out in the first round. However, there was a mailbag question about her, so I'm just going to hold off on it. But the two I want to talk about are Giovanni Pecci-Pericar beating Sebastian Korda, a situation where Alejandro Davidovich-Fokina withdraws due to injury. Lucky loser, Pecci-Pericar, probably a stiffer test on grass, at the very least, a more uncomfortable opponent for Korda compared to Davidovich-Fokina. Not that ADF is an easy draw in the first round of a major, even though his record isn't good on grass. He's lost a ton of five setters at Wimbledon. It feels like maybe it's just two, but I don't know. It feels like a million. It might be three, honestly. Point is, Pecci-Pericar is going to shrink the margins in a big way. It's going to be hard to break serve. You look at his statistics, I mean, it's full serve bot, right? He does not break serve at a high rate at all. I mean, he's under, on the Challenger Tour, he's well under 15%. On the main tour, his numbers are actually a little bit higher. Maybe it's because of how much he's played on clay. He's still easily under 15% break percentage. So let's make no mistake, this is a dude in kind of the Isner, Opelka, Hurkacz mold for now, although he does have the ability to do some pretty special things in flashes with his athleticism. Now, he does not move like a Hurkacz or a Zverev or Medvedev, certainly, but he carries a lot of weight on his body. He is probably one of the heavier, maybe the heaviest player in the top 100, because unlike a lot of the really tall guys that we've seen, like Isner, like Opelka, like Ivo Karlovic, Pecci-Pericar is actually kind of, I don't know, thick. Like, he's got meat on the bones. And he is athletic. He is athletic. So, and his forehand is big, and he can create some special stuff with his forehand. And I'll point out, you know, he hit an incredible forehand passing shot in the game that he broke serve in the fifth set. He also hit a phenomenal inside-in forehand, which not only great shot production, but also really good footwork getting around it on set point in the third set, I want to say. Yeah, because Korda won the fourth in a tiebreak, but this was the third set. But the biggest thing was Pecci-Pericar's serving was insane. And he continuously made excellent serves down break point. He saved something like 10 out of 10. I don't have the stats in front of me, and I didn't write it down. But he was something like 10 out of 10 break points saved. Not only was he hitting big first serves, he was hitting massive second serves. And that was incredibly uncomfortable. And the double fault number was high, but it wasn't so high that it was giving Korda any relief. And in fact, I do want to kind of pull up the stats here because, you know, there are a couple of interesting things and exciting things about Pecci-Pericar, but one of them is I think he might be, and we saw this with Maxime Cressy, who unfortunately wasn't able to really maintain his place on the tour, at least not at, on ATP level. But Petri Perikar, unlike anyone I've ever seen since Cressy, is pretty committed to the two first serve strategy. And there's a lot of data that suggests, you know, it's pretty easy to figure out if it's a kind of a value play or not based on how many neutral rallies do I expect to win? How many first serves do I expect to make? What percent do I expect to win on that level? Like, it's not that difficult to create an algorithm that determines whether or not you'd be better off going for two first serves. And for me, it's refreshing to see a guy with the construct of Petri Perikar, massive first serve weapon, not going to win a lot of baseline rallies because his backhand is so exposable. His movement is far below average unless you're grading him on a complete curve based on his size. So how am I going to win second serve points if I'm not going to be winning baseline rallies? Well, Petri Perikar won 51% of his second serve points. That'll do. That'll do when you are making 71% of your first serves and you're winning 84% of your first serve points because you're hitting absolute bombs. And not only are you hitting aces on your first serves, you're hitting some aces on your second serves. I wish the stat sheet separated it out. Normally, there's no need for the stat sheet to separate out because nobody is hitting second serve aces. But Petri Perikar finishes with 51 aces. That is rare air. 93 winners. So look, and by the way, the breakpoint stat that I couldn't tell you earlier, 0 of 11. Korda was 0 of 11. All of the breakpoints I saw, Korda wasn't given much of a chance. I don't know if he made any big mistakes on those 11. That's one of those things. First round, I'm watching too many matches. But long story short, Petri Perikar, if he's going to serve with that kind of clutchness, is going to have a chance to beat almost anyone if he serves like that. Now, is he always going to serve that well? I don't think so. I think that was a far above average serving performance from Petri Perikar. And for Korda, man, second straight tough first round loss at Wimbledon. After a promising lead up, he made the Queen's semis last year, and it was a good run to the Queen's semis. And then he said, I think I'm a Wimbledon title contender, which he never should have said. And that's what we were talking about this time last year after Korda lost in the first round, where I was saying, you know, why would you put that kind of pressure on yourself? Why would you put that out there? Now, for some people, it might be okay, but for most, it's just going to be counterintuitive. It's going to be counterproductive, rather, sorry. And then here, it's not a good draw, but he goes final, semifinal, Hertogenbosch, Queens. Reverse those, and loses in the first round again. And Korda has not passed the third round at a slam since Australian Open in 2023. So last year, but that is now six slams in a row. Kind of afraid he's mentally in a place where he kind of has the slam yips. Moving on, last one. Andrei Rublev loses today to Francisco Comesaña in four sets. Francisco Comesaña, Argentine, slam debut, first tour win, second ever grass court match, first grass court win, 16 career finals across all levels in his pro career. I'm including 15Ks. Nothing off clay. Nothing off clay. So, welcome to the big time. What a start. Congrats to him. Now, in terms of the match itself, and I'll start by giving Comesaña his flowers. Absolutely terrific defense from him. I was so impressed with how well he was able to just make every ball that he could get his racket on under pressure moving into the corners. And sometimes on his forehand especially, he was able to hit over the ball and drive it. And then the slice defense was awesome off of both wings as well. I love his forehand, and he's got a pretty long swing path that looks very clay courty, but it comes through really quickly. So despite the swing path being long, that can actually be a good thing if you're not rushable. And he didn't look very rushable because there was a sense of kind of maneuverability with the way he was able to bring his racket through that seemed very solid to me. And I liked the look of it. And if you were to ask me about Comesaña's forehand, spinny or flat, I wouldn't really know what to tell you. I'd tell you neither. And I like that because it's got a very nice shape to it. It's penetrating, but there's margin. It's got that nice kind of cliffhanger. We're not hitting it loopy because especially on grass, that often backfires, sits up into the hitting zone, doesn't really damage as much as you want to. But it's also not flat like a quarter forehand where you're looking at it and you're questioning, is there enough margin on this where you're going to be able to produce it over and over again without missing? And I find Comesaña's forehand to really fit in that sweet spot. Surprising serve level given his background. Again, we don't love to generalize, but it's a South American player who has come up on clay. By the way, he's 22 years old, in case you're curious. I would be. A South American player who plays a ton on clay, you don't expect that profile of player to come out and serve great. Comesaña doesn't have a bomb of a serve, but there's enough on it, and he hit spots really well. So I was really pleasantly surprised by the serving, and he has an excellent backhand slice, which he used often against Rublev. Andre does not like his low backhand. Match point was a backhand slice, forced error in the fourth set tiebreak. Rublev had a lot of issues, though. Baseline consistency was not where it needs to be, and it's the most underrated part of Rublev's game. Because he hits the ball hard and he's an offensive player, it's easy to lose sight of the fact that he's not a guy who gives you a lot of neutral groundstroke errors. But he certainly did in this match, particularly in the first set. Lots on the forehand. I thought returns in play were an issue for Andre, and they have been repeatedly in 2024. You know, here and there that's popped up as an issue. And on grass, it's one of the reasons why I, with the struggles, of course, factoring in, I didn't take Andre too seriously as a threat coming into Wimbledon this year. And ultimately, I picked him to lose to Musetti, not Francisco Comesaña, who I had never seen play before. I wasn't going to pick Rublev to lose to him. But I just don't love his ability to make a lot of returns in play against quality servers. Protecting his second serve, so important on the grass. It was Rublev's main weakness in his game, undoubtedly the main weakness in his game, dating back several years ago. He's made it much better, but why recently have I seen glimpses, flashbacks of the old Andre Rublev second serve, which just comes in very slow and attackable? And on grass, you're going to get hurt on the aggressive return. Because if you're put on the defense right away, there's many times there's no coming back from that on this surface. That first strike is so important. And it's just essential that if you're hitting your second serve, you're not immediately having to defend. I thought Rublev's second serve was a little bit too attackable for the most part. He did have trouble defending and passing on his backhand side. And mentally, a lot of people will point to this. I mean, you know, you just saw that constant agitation. And it's hard for me to say, is this different? Is Rublev mentally on the court? Is it any different from what it normally has been for Andre Rublev, even when he's playing well? That's kind of what I'm thinking to myself as I'm watching. Or is it just the same Andre And now we're going to look at the body language and we're going to say, that's why you're losing, or that's a problem now that he's losing. And that would be unfair, right? It wouldn't make any sense if we just read the same exact body language from Andre. And when it's winning, we'd say, oh, it doesn't matter, it's fine. And when he's losing, we'd say, oh, it's a big problem. That wouldn't make any sense. So it's hard for me to say, and it's always been difficult to judge with Rublev in this sense. But if I were to perceive a difference, it would be this. It would be that I found in the past that Rublev would at least pick his spots to blow up. And then he'd blow up and he'd move on. And maybe it would last several points, or there'd be a 5-minute stretch where he's really boiling over. But then I would feel at some point it would just come back to some level of serenity. And maybe I'm crazy, maybe I'm imagining this, but watching this match against Komesanya, it's almost like Rublev for 4 hours was pissed. And it never, ever got better. He was pissed for 4 hours. It's hard to imagine that that is a path to optimal performance. And it's okay to be someone who blows off steam. I'd like to see Rublev do it without going freaking ham on his kneecap. Okay, that would be awesome if he could take that out of the equation. But in general, I'm all right with the emotions coming out on a regular basis. But when it's just constant and there's no relief from it, I think it's a window into how negative he is in his own head right now constantly, which is probably inhibiting him in some way or another. It is an absolutely bizarre stretch for Andre Rublev. Totally bizarre. Since March, actually, you can go back, I think, to February. No, you can't go back to February. Since March, he has failed to make the round of 16 at every single tournament he's played except Madrid. It is objectively, and I don't even need to look to check this because I know how consistent Andre Rublev has been over the past couple of years. It has objectively been his worst stretch since 2018, 2019. But then there's the Madrid title in there. That in itself is strange. Gets even stranger when you consider the fact that he won that title having been barely able to breathe. He can't eat. He can't get out of bed. He's exhausted. He's in horrible condition when he wins that Madrid title. And that's the highlight by miles, by planets. That's the highlight of his last 3-4 months. Very, very strange. I mean, they should hire someone to study this. How is it possible that Andre Rublev's best and only positive result in the last 3 months was when he was sick as a dog? All right, first mailbag question. It comes from First Nadal, Now Sinner. That's such a good profile name. Really spells it out for us. Hello, Gil. My comment is about a phrase I keep hearing from pundits/podcasters. Incidentally, not from you, with regards to Carlos Alcaraz, that he, quote, has the highest ceiling. First, I will admit to my bias since I am not an Alcaraz fan. But secondly, and more importantly, I question the usefulness of such a phrase. If the goal is to stimulate engaging tennis discourse, this phrase does the opposite. It shuts down all discussion pretty darn quickly. Speaking for myself, when I hear it, I turn the channel off or stop the podcast. If we are so sure whose ceiling is higher, why bother to have predictions or discussions? Furthermore, how can we be 100% sure of anyone's ceiling? Players are always evolving. Not everyone thought Nadal or even Djokovic would have the career they ended up having. From what I've gathered, Fed was the end-all be-all. Thoughts? Thanks for this forum and all you do. I'm sure it's a lot harder and more time-consuming than you make it look. All the best. Appreciate that. Good question. I wouldn't be so repulsed by the conversation about a ceiling in tennis. However, I also think it should be emphasized that ceiling often doesn't matter all that much. So when people have conversations about the peak or the ceiling, I will entertain the conversation. I'm happy to have the conversation, but does it matter? Nick Kyrgios might have a higher ceiling than David Ferrer. His career never measured up, not even close. And that is to say that if Nick, just based on his baseline ability and some of his gifts, if Nick spent his entire career being entirely professional off the court and working on his fitness as hard as he worked on his fitness in 2022, if he did that his entire career, took care of his body, and was competitive, was able to kind of give it his all for large periods of time, and kind of sustain that, would he have likely had a better career than David Ferrer? Yeah. So we can have a conversation about the ceiling, but does it matter? Yeah, I guess with Alcaraz, though, you know, it's about, I guess, just looking at his peak level, and oftentimes the whole ceiling thing is going to favor the most spectacular offensively minded players. I think I recently talked about Mats Wilander saying that Alcaraz is a better player than Sinner, and I don't have a problem with that take. Like, if that is your take, that's totally fine. In fact, for most of the past 3 years, that's been my take on the comparison between those two. And I've kind of changed my opinion recently, and now I don't think there's much between the two, other than Alcaraz being younger, which by a little bit, but it still means something. And obviously having a head start because he was better quicker. So he's at three slams and Sinner is at one. I get all that. But if we're looking at ceilings, I just think it's usually, that conversation is usually going to favor the player who's more spectacular offensively. And I don't think that always signals who's going to be the best player or who is going to win the matches. So what Mats Wilander said, what I pushed back about that was he seemed to say that Alcaraz is better because the match is usually on his racket. And I don't really subscribe to that thinking. I generally think that that is not sound, not a sound logic. All right, anything else here? And then the part about sometimes us being wrong about ceilings, I mean, that's true for anything, right? Anything we talk about, we can be wrong about. Were we wrong about Nadal and Djokovic's ceiling? Sure. I mean, I think there are plenty of players who... Okay, here's an example. Sinner. When I looked at Sinner's game, I've always thought he's going to be a great player. I've always admired his rate of improvement, his skill set. But watching him as a young player, I never thought he was going to be an elite mover. I just didn't see it. I thought he was too far away from being that. And his development in that area surprised me. Just didn't see it coming. So you're right. There's always going to be individual instances in which someone can make an informed analysis about someone's serve or someone's movement or someone's mental game. And yeah, unexpected things can happen. I don't think that necessarily means that we should never discuss ceiling, though. I think as long as we acknowledge the limitations to how much it matters, I think it's okay to talk about it. Next one is from Miles. Gil, longtime viewer, somehow my first time in the mailbag. First memories of you are from 2017 Australian Open, when I really fell in love with this sport. Waking up at 3 a.m. to watch Fed until the sun came up and I had to go to school. I'm glad to see your growth through the years. You have taught me how to think critically about this wonderful sport we all love. That is heartwarming. And 2017 Australian Open is, I think, the first time I ever made a video about tennis. I'm serious. I think that is the very start. And it always amazes me when people say stuff like that, because I look back on those videos and I feel like my entire presentation is is not ideal, but I understand also that it's about the content sometimes. And what I was saying was still, I think, pretty good usually, but the way I was delivering it, when I look back on it, rough. Okay. My question is about drop shots, which I-
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
Most weight loss plans are one size fits all, but Noom builds personal plans that meet your needs. Noom takes into account dietary restrictions, medical issues, and other personal needs to build the plan that works for you. Noom is built for your psychology and your biology. Noom Weight uses psychology. That's why they say losing weight starts with your brain, but it also takes into account your unique biological factors, which also affect weight loss success. The program helps you understand the science behind your eating choices and why you have cravings. Everyone's journey is different, so your daily lessons are personalized to you and your goals. Noom helps you build new habits for a healthier lifestyle. To date, Noom has helped more than 5.2 million people lose weight. Noom's flexible program focuses on progress instead of perfection. Stay focused on what's important to you with Noom's psychology and biology-based approach. Sign up for your trial today at Noom.com. That's N-O-O-M.com. And check out Noom's first ever cookbook, The Noom Kitchen, for 100 healthy and delicious recipes to promote better living. Available to buy now wherever books are sold. Individual results may vary. Visit our website at Noom.com for more information.
I think have become a necessary tool to build and finish points on tour. Why is just about every dropper hit over the high part of the net towards the sideline? Maximizing your opponent's distance to run is an obvious answer, but today's players are unbelievably good at hitting that shot cross court. That short cross court reply if they do get there. Seriously, how consistently pros hit the shot to a small target on the dead run is insane. If you drop shot to the middle of the court, it seems like you take away this angled counterattack while being able to hit it slightly lower to the court. Yes, your opponent is more likely to get to the ball, but if you follow it in, the only thing they can really hurt you with is a lob or pace down the middle if you don't have good reflexes. Would love to hear your thoughts on this. Thank you for everything. Yeah, fantastic question. I think there are two things to think about here. If you're hitting a ground stroke, an attacking ground stroke, especially from inside the court, if you're trying to finish with it, be offensive with it and do damage, you're probably trying to bring down the net clearance because you're flattening out, you're going for pace. And that is where the height of the net matters a lot, which is why we always talk about how it's a lot safer to go cross court over the low part of the net, which is exactly 6 inches lower than the highest part of the net closer to the sidelines. And 6 inches can be a really big difference. And that's with the singles net sticks in, you know, regulation nets. When a drop shot should have some loft on it. So even though you're trying to hit it as short in the court as possible, and therefore as close to the net as possible, you are hitting that shot with some shape. There's some arc. So I'm not convinced that the net clearance on your average drop shot is actually not, I think it's quite high. I actually think most drop shots clear the net by quite a bit. I know that's weird because we're talking about a shot that we want to hit short, but think about it not as a depth thing, because if you hit the ball so short that it lands, you know, before the net, that's a depth problem, and it doesn't matter. High part of the net, low part of the net, you're going to hit the net in that case pretty much. So certainly you want to take away as much depth as possible. But I guess what I'm saying is if you hit the net on a drop shot, you probably hit the drop shot too short. And it's probably not a matter of height of net at that point. Because you should be getting enough air on your drop shot. If you're hitting it as a line drive, that's not really what you're going for, because that second bounce is going to be too deep in the court. You can hit it flatter or straighter, but you probably shouldn't be. And therefore, I don't think height of the net actually matters as much as you might think it would. So that's the first thing. As far as where should you hit your drop shots, like what's a smart target on the drop shot? One thing, and I know Hugh Clark has covered this on his newsletter, Threat of Order, I think you do want to see how can I make my opponent run a further distance, but perhaps just as important is how do I make my opponent change direction on the most extreme basis. If you drop shot me to the side that I'm recovering to, I'm able to use some of the momentum I already have in my recovery towards the middle. Okay? So that's one thing that should factor into where you're hitting the drop shot. But the last thing I want to say is I really like your idea of drop shotting down the middle and coming in to take away the angle. I think that's a phenomenal play. So do we see that sometimes? I think so. Maybe not enough. I think in general, hitting middle is just usually underplayed as a directional, and maybe it's no different from drop shots, but I don't think height of net plays in much because of the trajectory of the ball and the shape, the loft that you get on a drop shot. Next one from user. Hey Gil, a lot of people have said that players like Zverev, Tsitsipas, and Medvedev were unfortunate to be playing while the big three were still winning all of the slams. Are Alcaraz and Sinner different, or would they have had the same problems winning slams in the 2017 through 2021 period? Medvedev did win one, but still lost four finals to Nole and Rafa. How do you think a hypothetical match would go if Alcaraz, who won Wimbledon last year, faced Federer in 2017 or 2019 Wimbledon, or if Sinner, who won Australian Open, faced Federer in the 2018 Australian Open final? Do you think Carlos would have been able to beat a healthy Nadal at RG? I don't like these hypotheticals generally, but my simple answer is I think they would have taken slams away from each other. To me, they would have had good battles, and it would have been harder for the big three to come away with their hardware, and it would have been harder for Alcaraz to come away with his hardware compared to a Casper Ruud, who he beat in the U.S. Open final to win his first major. But certainly, Alcaraz is a better player than Marin Cilic, who Federer played twice in major finals to win the 2018 Australian Open and Wimbledon in 2018. So it works both ways. But of course, there's always this conversation that pops up. And I actually talked about it recently on Twitter, where it's like, are Alcaraz and Sinner really better players than Zverev, Tsitsipas, and Medvedev? Or are they just coming up at the right time? And I would say it's the former. They're just better. Now, the first thing I would submit is that Zverev, Tsitsipas, Medvedev, they're basically in their primes right now. So if they're not winning slams right now, it's not a product of, oh, poor them, they had to deal with the big three era. No, I mean, right now should be their time. But what's happening? Well, they're in, you know, in, especially in the case of Tsitsipas, just last slam in the case of Zverev losing to Alcaraz, they're losing at times to Sinner and Alcaraz now. But I think also if you take away their accomplishments completely and just evaluate them as players, I think you'll find Alcaraz and Sinner have fewer weaknesses. And you got to even include the mental stuff here. They have fewer weaknesses. And in a lot of cases, they have just as many, if not more, strengths. Next one is from Jay Drog. Hey, Gil, could you expand on your Ben Shelton skepticism coming into Wimbledon? I understand the recent result against Jubb and not having the most stellar clay performance, but I think he's the type of player with high potential to catch fire in slams and punch above his typical level to go on a deep run. Seems like small shot slash play style adjustments could pay dividends in his grass court results. I'm just going to answer the first part. I know there's part two to that question, but let me just take on the first part. Look, I think first of all, just in general, there's just a lot of, I'm not saying you're doing this in this comment, but I like to dig deeper than the dude has a big serve, so they're going to be good at Wimbledon. Because I think it's so much deeper than that, right? Look at Zverev. Look at John Isner, who is better at Roland Garros than he was at Wimbledon. Shelton, who had struggled coming into Wimbledon and just beat Matteo Bellucci in five. And he might have been saved by the darkness because he was down 2-1 when play was delayed. We'll never know. It's not fair to take anything away from Ben. But it's a matter of fact. He was losing the match. They got to get a break in the action, restart the next day. And then from there, Shelton actually dominated 4-5 to his credit and figured some stuff out with the angled kick serves and the angled slice serves on both ends that were really, really effective. And he got more solid as well. But I like to try to just kind of dig beyond the serve a little bit. So let's think about Shelton. How does he play from the baseline? I think he plays with a lot of spin generally off of both wings. That's not really helpful on grass. Is he a guy who looks to run around and hit a lot of forehands? Is that an essential part of his point construction? Is that an essential part of how he maximizes his strength and minimizes his weakness? Yes, it is. Well, guess what? You can't run around as many forehands on grass. Is he a guy who enjoys higher contact points or lower contact points? I actually don't think it matters much for him, but I think that's a factor for Medvedev and for Zverev. So I guess all I would say, and I could go deeper kind of player by player here and find you examples of players who served well but aren't as good on grass as you might think, right? Like, okay, Isner is a perfect example of a lot of these things. He doesn't want the ball low. He wants the ball high. That's, you know, you don't want grass there. By the way, how much do you rely on your kick serve? How important is your kick serve to your success? It's very important to Shelton. It's very important to Isner. We think about grass as serving servers' conditions. Yes, they are servers' conditions, but they're more so servers' conditions if you're going to hit flat serves and you're going to hit slice serves. It's not going to help your kick serve. And for Shelton, that's a major problem. And for Isner, I think with his second serve, it was a small problem because it wasn't like clay where John's second serve was like impossible to deal with. Zverev comes down to some of the baseline passivity. So I guess what I would really strongly encourage is just to think a little bit more critically about whether or not a player is suitable for grass based on things like, another thing, do you crave time on the ball? If you're a player who needs a lot of time on the ball in order to produce your best possible ground game, that's not really going to be on offer on grass. Whereas some players have compact strokes and they take the ball early well, they don't need a lot of time in order to produce their power and to strike the ball clean on a consistent basis. Those guys aren't going to mind grass. Think about more than the surf. So I think with Shelton, the big ones are how spinny he plays off the ground, how much time he craves, and how important his runarounds are. How important it is that, because his backhand is a weakness. I think it's a lot easier to get to his backhand on grass versus a slower hard court. All right. Leave it at that. Let's go to the next one. It is from Urig. Hi, Gil. Can you explain how Sinner suddenly became Grand Slam winner and a guy that's definitely the best player in 2024? Before Canada last year, he didn't even have anything over a 500. How can someone become so good so quick? His results are just unbelievable and make no sense. How can transformation from a very good player to become number one so quick? Who would have thought that after typical Sinner US Open slam performance, he will become number one in 6 months? All right. I giggled through this comment, but I actually think like your reaction to what's happened here is appropriate. The rate at which Sinner improved, how quickly it clicked, and that's the word I like to use, clicked, because for some players, it happens kind of slowly. And for Sinner, I think it was all about the work he put in and the slow building he did to bring his game to the point that it could click. But yeah, once it kind of came together, it seemed to happen in an instant. And I think that has made it hard to kind of understand how to kind of even process what's happened here. Well, look, I've covered where Sinner has made gains repeatedly, but what was kind of remarkable about last year is it was almost hard to figure out what was the most important aspect of it. Is it his serve? Is it his physicality? Is it his variety where instead of being such a straight line power player, he creates angles now, he drops shots now, he comes forward and finishes volleys. Is that it? Is it the sheer consistency and the toughness, the mental toughness, which has even gotten better? So it's all of these things at once that were improving slowly, but just seem to take this sudden quantum leap all at once. And now you had Jannik Sinner, and it was hard. What I kept saying at the end of last year after watching his game was I was like, damn, where does he still need to get better in order to get to the top? And I started to be at a loss for words when trying to answer that question. I also started to be at a loss for words when people were asking me when Sinner was on this tear of how do we beat him? And the fact that I was at such a loss trying to answer those questions told me everything I needed to know about where my head should be at when it comes to Sinner. So my thing was, look, I'll be a little bit skeptical in January when it comes to the Australian Open, because sometimes the offseason can kind of disrupt that. But as soon as I saw what he did at the Australian Open, I said, okay, I've seen enough. This guy's elite. This guy's top tier. And he has maintained it to his credit. Next one from David. Hey, Gil, what do you make of Francis Tiafoe's comments after his win over Arnaldi? Quote, literally this week last year, I was 10 in the world, and now I'm barely seated here at Wimbledon, losing to clowns. I hate to say it, but I'm just going to be honest. This is the end of the quote. People seem to be getting quite mad at him for it. And while I do think he should have phrased it better, he is just coming off of a 2-sets-to-love comeback for the first time in his career and has a microphone in his face 5 minutes later. So I feel it's unfair to jump on anything a player says when emotions are high. I believe players like him and Shelton are already unfairly treated for not being robots and actually having a personality. And after the whole Fedal Laver Cup thing where he hit Federer, some of the stuff being said about Francis was disgusting. Would love to hear your thoughts. Well, I agree with a lot of what you say here. I also try to not jump on a player after what they, you know, when they say stuff right after a match. And I also think that there's a ton of animosity. Some of it fair game. If you don't like the more energetic, celebratory kind of players on tour, that's okay. Some of it's fair game. Some of it really crosses a line when it comes to the criticism that I think are levied online when it comes to Tiafo and Shelton. Anyway, taking this comment alone, it's obviously not a great thing to call your previous opponents clowns. Not a good thing to say. I would also just be a little bit, and here's where I think anyone who doesn't like Tiafo to begin with is likely not to think this way, but let me try to introduce this thinking into the equation. Let's actually consider intention here. What was Tiafo trying to do? Now, whatever he was trying to do, he did so poorly because you shouldn't call people a clown. You shouldn't call your opponents who beat you clowns, obviously. But what was he going for here? I actually think he was going for self-deprecation. He was trying to kind of honestly be hard on himself. It was directed at himself. He was obviously the butt of his own joke. It wasn't a joke, but you know what I'm saying? Like, he's the punchline here. So everybody was saying, if you were losing to clowns, who's the clown? As if that was some sort of Francis Tiafo own. Francis knows that. That was the point of his comment. The point of his comment was kind of like, he's calling himself a clown. Right? I mean, that's what he's doing. If you're losing to clowns, then what are you? That's what everyone was saying. That's Francis's point. Right? He was trying to be self-deprecating. It did not come off well. It was a misfire. It was a misfire in communication. But let's also be realistic about what Tiafo was trying to say. Was he trying to diss his previous opponents? No, he wasn't trying to diss his previous opponents, even if he accidentally did so. He was trying to be self-deprecating. And maybe he kind of forgot where he was, because frankly, I think a lot of players in Tiafo's position would probably say something like this in private and not so much in public. Francis, like, to me, it kind of reads like a bit of a slip up in that sense. All right. This one from Discord. Again, it is from Noodle Lad Jr. Just a reminder, if you missed it at the start of the video, if you want to join the Discord community, which has been very active first 2 days of Wimbledon, which has been fun. I try to jump in there as much as I can. The link is in the description. Okay, so from Noodle. Hey, Gil, I wanted to ask a question following up on this tweet since it touches on something I've wanted to ask about. So, okay, let me stop here and read my tweet. My tweet says, Vondrosova doesn't have the kind of play style typically associated with a high degree of variance. RG final ranked 38th, Olympic final ranked 41, Wimbledon title ranked 42, all spread across 2 year intervals. No flukes when it happens three times, but she's never sustained top 10 tennis. All right, there's kind of a non sequitur in my tweet. It didn't flow very well, and that's because I was running out of characters, and that's what tends to happen. But basically, my point of the tweet was Vondrosova has made these incredible runs. And it's happened so often that it's just, at that point, it's not a fluke. However, she has never been a consistent top player, week to week to week for a long stretch of time. It's never happened. You can look at her win rates year by year by year, never been above 70. You can look at her year-end rankings, year to year to year. And you'll come to similar conclusions. Now, a lot of that has been because of health, because of injuries. But what fascinates me about Vondrousova is her career has had this pattern of really, really high highs and then lulls, and really, really high highs and then lulls. We associate that happening with a different kind of player, not someone who puts a lot of balls in court and defends really well and moves really well and has a lot of craftiness and variety to the game. And that's kind of the point I was trying to make about Vondrousova. So now let's go back to the question. It says, okay, what makes some players high variance in your view? Is it the types of problems in their game, maybe technical versus mental? I always feel like some players are always capable of upsets of anybody when locked in, such as Runa in 2022, while others don't get upset or really upset people, Rublev 2022 to 2023. Right, there are some players who you feel like always beat who they're supposed to beat, but don't punch up above their weight. They don't beat players who are higher than them in the rankings or are top players, top tier players. There are both of those kinds of examples that we can find quite easily. So what explains that? There's no one size fits all answer, but I do think it's a little bit less surprising when we see that in a player like Denis Shapovalov, for example. Like, I remember a few years back, even when he was a consistent top 20 player before the health stuff came up, and there were always questions about, Gil, why is Shapo just losing these random first round matches that you wouldn't expect him to lose? Why can't he be consistent? And it's like, well, there's a pretty simple dynamic that plays out where when Shapovalov is bad, he is beating himself, he is making a lot of errors, and therefore he doesn't raise the bar all that high for his opponent to beat him. He does not ask all that much of his opponent to beat him on a bad day. Whereas on a good day, his incredible firepower that comes from all directions is difficult to deal with. Can take the racket out of your hands, no matter who you are. So that's a player, okay, it makes sense. You're going to go on some great runs. You're also going to take some surprising losses. Whereas a player like, I think Alex de Minaur was like this for a long time in his career, but you can create, I guess, a more extreme example like Jaume Munar, who's been very consistent in his career. This is a guy who's not going to miss, really. He's never going to beat himself ever. He's going to set a certain bar every single match almost. Are you going to clear it? If you're a certain level player, if you're a top 50 level player, you're probably going to clear the bar that Jaume Munar, who, by the way, picked up a good win in the first round here at Wimbledon. Forget who he played. You're probably going to clear that bar if you're a top 50 player. You're probably not going to clear that bar if you are a player outside of the top 100. Billy Harris was who Munar beat today. So I think consistency is often a part of this conversation, but not always. There's clearly other factors. Like, are you someone who has varying degrees of effort at times? Varying degrees of focus. Are you someone who is a little bit inconsistent physically, right? Like, I don't know, Elena Rybakina this season, has she had a consistent year? I don't think you can say that. Why? Because she hasn't been able to stay, I hate to use the word fit for the case of Rybakina because so often it's been illness. But because she hasn't been able to feel her best on a consistent basis. And that can be a trend throughout someone's career even. It can be a long-lasting thing. Whereas you can have an iron woman or an iron man where it feels like every time they take the court, they're completely fine physically, or they always bring it mentally, no matter what surface they're on, no matter what they did last week. Some players have really fragile confidence, and that can mean that they go in a lot of slumps. They get cold. They get ice cold. Like Sebastian Baez, to me, has gone on in his career so far way too many severe losing streaks. That tells me something about his psyche. It tells me that he can nosedive from a confidence standpoint and he can have trouble getting it back. On the other hand, Sebastian Baez, for how early he is in his career, he has gone on so many brilliant runs. And that shows me his capability, his ceiling. So there are a lot of different things. What is it for Vondrousova, though? I think that that's hard to answer. But it's kind of confounding to me. Part of it is physical because she hasn't been able to stay healthy much. Last 12 or so months, though, she has been able to stay pretty healthy. That being said, it was a factor today that she wasn't seemingly able to move her best in the loss today that she suffered to Bothas. Who, by the way, I called her first round Roland Garros match, Jessica Bothas Monero, and solid player all around, who makes a lot of balls, but I can't exactly say that I saw this coming. That's for sure. Vondrousova is going to drop down to like between 15 or 17 in the live rankings, likely. Right now she's 15 live. Which, you know, feels about right, I think, for her level. Her ranking was starting to feel a little bit inflated, I would say. But I just think Vondrousova's case, it's difficult to figure out why she is so up and down, why she is so hot and cold. We talk about ceilings and floors. She's a player, high ceiling. I don't want to say low floor, because you look at what she's done since the Wimbledon title last year. There are a lot of big quarterfinals. There's a U.S. Open quarterfinal. There is a Roland Garros quarterfinal. There might be Australia, maybe. I can't quite remember. But, you know, she just hasn't been able to repeat anything close to what she did at the All England Club, going on a run to the final weekend. That's all. All right, let's keep going. From Amit. Hi, Gil, love your podcast.
This episode brought to you by Progressive. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity. Much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save over $775 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the home gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $779 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
Passion, drive, and patience. The formula for winning championships is also what keeps your ride or die alive. eBay Motors has everything you need to maintain your vehicle and level it up to peak performance. Superchargers, roof racks, exhaust kits, LED headlights, and more. Whether you're into speed, power, or style, eBay Motors has you covered. With over 122 million parts for your number one ride or die, you'll always find exactly what you're looking for. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, your part is guaranteed to fit your ride every time or your money back. Because with eBay Motors, you're burning rubber, not cash. With all the parts you need at the prices you want, it's easy to make your car the MVP and bring home huge wins. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply. See ebaymotors.com.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
Highly disagree on your men's side picks this year, but who would you pick for the women's side this Wimbledon? Does Iga have a chance this year? I think Iga has a great chance. In fact, Iga is my pick. Iga is my pick to win Wimbledon. And it's tempting to go with Rybakina because I like basically everyone else. I love the way her flat ground strokes penetrate through the grass. I love the way she squares up aggressive second serve returns off of both wings. I love the way she serves. But am I fully confident that mentally she's going to be present and without any costly hiccups over the course of seven matches? That physically she's going to hold up over the course of seven matches? I have enough concern in that area where I'll look the other way. And I see the improvements that Iga has made in her serve, in her ability to absorb pressure on her forehand wing without letting that forehand side get rushed and without letting it kind of beat herself. I think she's a more mature player tactically, especially when she's facing hyper-offensive players. It's something I've covered a lot. It's been a concern at Wimbledon, although I will say, like, the last two losses at Wimbledon, Cornet, Svitolina, not exactly ball bashers. And I have a general belief, you guys know this, I have a general belief that players who dominate on clay and hard court are going to figure it out and be able to translate it onto the grass at a certain point, unless there are obvious reasons why that can't happen technically. And I can kind of go through those things, which I've already talked about earlier in the mailbag. Like, does she need to run around? Does she need a lot of time on the ball? Does she need a higher contact point? Does she play from too deep in the court? Like, I can go through this checklist. To me, there is nothing. Now, why is she lost at Wimbledon last 2 years? I just feel like she's had these crises of confidence, maybe partially mental burnout or physical burnout after long clay court seasons. With in the case of the Cornet loss, a lot of pressure on her shoulders given the win streak she was on. Last year, I thought, was a little bit harder to explain, especially after she won that epic against Bencic. But I feel like she's just thrown in these shockingly kind of erratic performances with her forehand, and I'm not seeing that as often this year, and I just think it's going to come together. I think it's going to come together for her because I don't see a very good reason why it's not going to come together for her. So I think she should be the favorite here. Next one from Nate. At his Dartmouth commencement speech, Federer mentioned that he won 54% of points in his career, and many in the tennis world received this point as if it was surprising. But imagine an NBA team winning 54% of points in a game. That would be equivalent to winning the game 118-100, which is a blowout. Now imagine having that be your typical performance throughout your career. My point is, winning 54% of points throughout your career is a lot, meaning that Federer's point is not as surprising as it seems like it is. Do you agree? I agree and I don't. Obviously, winning 54% of points is amazing in tennis. It means you are dominant. Federer is dominant. Djokovic, Nadal, dominant. 54% is just about the number that they are at. However, although that is dominant in tennis, it is still ultra important and informative to understand that even the best players in the world don't win that much above 50% of points. And it's actually sad that Federer's comments were as surprising as they were to some, if they even were. I didn't really see. I think maybe I did see some shock, some surprise and reaction. I think it should be one of the first things taught at every tennis academy across the world. It should be drilled into the minds of young players that your goal here is to win just a little bit more than half. And if you're doing that, you're in great shape. And I think it teaches you a couple things. It teaches you to, first of all, stay level-headed. You're going to lose points. Everybody loses points. It's okay. Chill out. It's a marathon, not a sprint. So many junior players are too emotional. They're getting too low after losing points, and maybe they're getting too high after winning points. And just understanding that it's going to be about 50-50 in a match, whether you like it or not, I think is a really good step in getting rid of that emotional volatility. The second thing is, every point matters. Margins are small. And every little incremental improvement in your game matters. The difference between winning 50% of points and 51% of points is everything. So that means focusing just a little bit extra, giving that a little bit extra to just steal a few points here and there from an effort standpoint. All of these things are crucial. They're critical. And if you constantly have that understanding and that expectation that the margins are going to be tiny and it's going to be just about 50-50, I think it's a great way to approach tennis. From EB, why on earth would top players like Novak and Medvedev practice with each other, letting one of their biggest rivals feel their ball out and potential weaknesses when they could face off in a semi or a final? Why not just practice with lower level players only? This is a good question. I imagine some people, or many people, have this question. First of all, Djokovic and Medvedev have played a ton. So in terms of understanding what the ball feels like, or even what playing each other feels like, secrets are out the window. It's gone. Now, tactics are another thing completely. And when these two practice, rest assured, they are not playing with tactics. Trust me, they are not playing tactics. And this is why when Djokovic beats Medvedev in straight sets in the exhibition, it should be brushed off. It doesn't matter. When, you know, like Djokovic came out in Paris-Bercy against Medvedev in 2021 and served volleyed a ton and it worked, he wouldn't have done that if they practiced together. He wasn't going to just serve volley over and over and over again. That was a secret. That needed element of surprise, even though it probably would have worked, even if it didn't have element of surprise. So they're not playing any tactics. They're focused on timing, footwork, hitting the ball well. They're not that focused on winning. Like, this is what people need to understand about practice. This is why I can't believe when folks report practice scores and all that. These are process-oriented exercises. Process-oriented in the sense, I want to get my game in tune. I want to serve well. I want to return well. I want to volley well. I want to hit my forehand well. Work on your skills. Get your timing down. That's what it's mostly about. Here's a fun one from J. Cole T. Hey Gil, with Wimbledon at our doorstep, it's the season for tradition. And alongside the many traditions that make tennis at this tournament so iconic, another tradition of Wimbledon is food. Most notably, the classic strawberries and cream dish that's been part of its heritage since the 1870s. This got me thinking from watching your channel over the years. I've gleaned that outside of tennis, one of your passions is food. And as a fellow foodie myself, I'm curious to know which tennis tournament do you think serves up the best dishes? Is there a tournament you haven't been to that has a reputation for great food? Thanks for the consistently great content. Appreciate it. Good question. I do have thoughts. I think the U.S. Open, and I don't just say this because I'm biased towards the U.S. Open and they employ me I think the U.S. Open has the best food out of any tournament I've been to. There are, you know, terrific options in New York every year, which tend to rotate on some level, but there are also some staples. The Miami Open was pretty good as well. I didn't find anything that was jackpot other than this spot that was serving me these Cuban coffees that I was pounding, and they were really good. And the croquetas from that place was pretty good as well. And, you know, in Miami, that also felt very of the location, which is always nice. Tell you what, like Wimbledon, it impressed me because I spent 6 weeks in London, and I know that British cuisine does not have a good reputation. And my experience after spending 6 weeks in London is it's deserved. Like, they don't deserve to have a good reputation in cuisine because, like, British food in itself, or I'd say, like, the food that you would call, like, native to Britain, I didn't find it to be all that enjoyable, in my opinion, for the most part. And by the way, I do love fish and chips in general, but, you know, I think everybody loves fish and chips. That's not part of why Britain has a bad food reputation. I think most of the good food that I found in London was either, you know, Asian food in some capacity, Chinese food, Indian food, Middle Eastern food. You know, that was the good food I ate in London. It usually wasn't, I don't know, white person food, for lack of a better term. But Wimbledon, they had one other thing other than strawberries and cream that I really did enjoy. It was a sausage with these like crispy fried shallots and this brown chutney sauce. And a big kind of thing in the U.S. is at sporting events is hot dogs. And I got to say, I kind of ate this, and normally you just have a hot dog on a potato bun with ketchup and mustard, and it's pretty crappy. Like, it's not good, but it's tradition. Wimbledon, that's a really good sports event food, because it, you know, it's easy to carry around. It's very mobile. It's very quick. And I really loved what was going on there with the sausage and the fried crispy shallots, which offered texture, which hot dogs don't have texture. Hot dogs are just like kind of mush, you know, other than maybe the snappiness of the skin on the outside. And this had texture, and it had sweetness and a little bit of tang with that chutney on the top that kind of cut the fat from the sausage. So I love that. That was great. And the strawberries and cream were really good as well. And I love Pimm's cups. Pimm's cups are awesome. I love them. Honey Deuce, US Open, another feature, obviously. So that's what stands out. Food at Indian Wells, highly forgettable. Food at Roland Garros, disappointing, highly forgettable. Any other tennis tournaments that I've been to that I would like to assess the food at? Queen's Club. I don't remember eating at the Queen's Club. I just remember it was when Fever Tree sponsored it and there were just gin and tonics everywhere. Yeah, I don't remember eating there. So yeah, I'm going to leave it at that. US Open, Miami Open have been by far the best. But Wimbledon, surprisingly good. From Home Slice. There's been a few interview questions about making slams best of three instead of best of five. Is this something that's been being seriously considered? What are your thoughts on it? I'm going to go rapid fire from here. My thoughts on it are, I don't understand, like, it seems very random that this has been a discussion point in press, right? What exactly has brought this on? Until it's a real thing that is being considered for some reason or another, I don't feel really like giving it oxygen. And me not giving it oxygen is not necessarily a result of, I think anyone who thinks it should be best of three has zero argument and deserves to be ignored. That's not what I'm saying. What I am saying is, what is this hypothetical conversation? Because right now, that's all it is. It's a useless hypothetical conversation. I don't know. There's no momentum or movement or considerations that are seriously happening right now to make men's tennis best of three at majors. So why are we even talking about it? I mean, I'm not in favor of it, but I don't feel the need to even defend best of five right now. It's irrelevant. Next one, it's from Gacciato. Hey, Gil, off the back of your analysis of the Sinner-Alcaraz semifinal at RG, in what conditions is it actually possible for both players in a high-profile match to, quote, play their best at the same time? Isn't the logic that, especially with the clash of styles, one player playing their best necessarily means preventing their opponent from doing the same? No, I think, I know there's some confusion about this. How could two players both be playing their best? Yes, there's going to be a winner and a loser always, but anything that can happen in a short, small sample can happen on a regular basis on a large sample. So I can show you plenty of points where both players did everything correctly. Both players did everything to the best of their ability. Maybe someone hit a great serve. Maybe there were 10 shots in the rally and all 10 shots were high quality. There's going to be a winner of the rally in that case. And the point may have even ended with an error. Or maybe, like, this happens a lot on clay. Maybe there was a 23-shot rally where there were 22 great balls and someone made an unforced error. To me, that's very different from someone made an unforced error on the second ball. A completely different thing. Where on the first point, the 23-shot rally that was rich in quality, I'm going to say, wow, great job by both players. Good stuff. You make an unforced error on the second ball, and if that is happening a lot, I'm going to be saying, well, this is sloppy. Stat sheet can't even tell you the difference between the two. But yeah, both players can play their best at the same time because sometimes in a tennis point, both players are doing a lot of things at a high level, and that can happen consistently over the course of a match. I'll be back after the second round for takeaways on everything that goes down over the course of the next 2 days at Wimbledon. Hope you enjoy. Don't forget to subscribe. I'll see you next time.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, didn't see that coming, and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.